You're listening to the Geek Saga podcast. This episode features audio that was recorded at a discussion panel at DragonCon 2024. Please consider backing us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to these podcasts and other perks.
All right, guys, it is 1 o'clock on the dot, so we're gonna get started. This is the House of the Dragon Season 2 panel. If you've not watched House of the Dragon Season 2, you're in the wrong room. There will be spoilers. And actually, let me ask before we do the rest of the cleanup stuff, how many of you have read Fire and Blood? So not many people have actually read Fire and Blood in here. Okay, so we'll do our best, at least as panelists, to not major. Technically, this is an all spoilers panel, but I want to, you know, be respectful of people who have not read the book. So we're going to do our best to not spoil anything too major. All right. Well, my name is Tara. You can find me online at Geek Saga. Been doing these high fantasy track panels since the track's inception in 2017. And I do have a podcast called The Geek Saga Podcast, and we do cover House of the Dragon. Our series on that is called Hot D Takes. And let's go down the line here and introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Courtney. I run a blog and podcast called Games for the Throne, and I'm also a producer, director, designer, sometimes actress.
My name is Billy Todd. I am primarily a Sanderson and Wheel of Time person, not historically participated in Thrones panels for High Fantasy Track because I'm not much of a Game of Thrones person. I do love House of the Dragon, and I'm explicitly a show person. I'm not a book person, so I'm incapable of getting books. So in that sense, you were safe from me at least.
And my name is Ryan Cahill, and just be gentle, tequila and karaoke is still in my voice, so I'm trying my best. But I'm an author. I write every fantasy. My TV series was The Diamond and Broken. And that's love dragons, and that's why I'm here.
So the way I usually run these things, we're going to kind of get the conversation started for a little bit. If you do have questions, if you can get up and use the mic, we do prefer that because then everybody will be able to hear you. This room does have better acoustics than we're used to, but it is a big room. So please use the mic for questions if you do have them, and there will be a very lengthy audience participation section of this panel. I'm big on audience participation. It is also Sunday, so the less I have to talk, the better. Okay, so just to get started, what was each of your hottest take from this season? Like, it can be anything. It can be something funny, it can be something serious, something you really enjoyed, though. Let's go with the positives first.
Things that we really enjoyed. I was struck by, particularly towards the end of the season, the degree to which the snowball is out of control. There's a sense of inertia here, right? That there are these forces that always seem to be at work in Westeros, which is at some point heads just are going to have to be cracked. And there's always this, like, there's this thing working here that people just want to go beat the hell out of each other. And now that snowball has been pushed down the hill, nobody really, even as they slowly discover the desire to stop it, that snowball now has its own power. And that's these conversations that we have between Rhaenyra and Allison across the season really, I think, demonstrate that in a way that is foretold in the first season, but now it's clear this is completely out of their control.
Yeah.
One thing I really love seeing, and we talked about it the other day on one of your panels, but like, Aegon's journey through it, I really, really, really loved watching the small, tiny moments where you realize this horrible little human really kind of just wanted to run away on the dragon all the time. And the little tiny moments, like, I was asked before this panel, someone said, are there any, like, happy moments in House of the Dragon? I said, there is one. And it lasts 5 seconds. And Aegon decides to get himself absolutely pissed and fly off to war to prove himself because everyone thinks he's a dipshit. And he gets drunk and he sees Sunfire as like a little border collie and he's just like, oh my god, I'm so happy to see you. And he like just boots him in the chest and Aegon for 5 seconds has a genuine smile on his face. Mm. And that moment, no matter what he did, it just kind of broke my heart a little bit in the best way. I was watching it going, oh, I really should feel bad for this guy. But in that moment, knowing what's going to happen next, I was like, oh, that's horrible. I love that it was horrible.
Yeah, I think mine was, of course, the Dragon Seeds. That was fun to watch. But actually seeing Helena show up in Daemon's vision and be like talking to him, that was really interesting to me.
Now, I would compare the dragons more to cats than a border collie, yeah. I think. But yeah, I really, really liked that.
I've never seen a cat that happy. Ever. Whereas, I think it was the Weevil.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Or do anything you ask it to do. That's really good.
Well, that was kind of the one moment where, like you said, Aegon has that sort of genuine smile on his face. Earlier in the season, there were like the scene in the throne room where he's trying to help out the people who are coming to petition him.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we're taking too many of your sheep. Well, yeah, we'll just give them back. And you know, I was like, no, we can't do that. Or, you know, paying the people who are doing their work for, I don't know, their materials before they do the work. That sounds like a pretty smart, nice thing to do.
It was a really great character work.
Yeah.
Incredible. One thing I say, no matter what feeling I had on anything, the character work is absolutely masterful. Like, it's brilliant.
Mm. Yeah, it's really good. And I really love that sequence with Egan there, because it's like, well, bringing kings not that hard. This is an easy decision. Right? It's like, you're the viewer. You're like, yeah, really, we could if you give these sheep back.
You can hold the sheep.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, what, I don't know, prepay your workers. Like, this doesn't seem that hard to do, right? Like, this seems like the right thing. And, oh, and he wants to do this. The right thing. Oh, it's because he's not actually being presented with a choice. They do a really good job of saying, like, this looks like the choice is being put in front of you, but it is not, viewer. The actual choice is now he's going to get they're going to beat him up over this back in the Privy Council, and that's where he actually has to make a choice. Mm. And he fails that choice.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think, too, that we talked a lot about on our podcast about how the beginning, especially of this season, was very much Team Green propaganda. Like, they're just really trying to make you have more positive feelings about the Greens. But also, as the season progressed and we saw how far downhill Aemond was sliding, I realized that maybe, very possibly, there was a chance they were building Aegon up a little bit to make it look worse when Aemond, you know, starts doing the things he's doing later in the season. So, but again, that goes back to the awesome character work.
I think there's also the piece there that, like, the reason why Aegon messes this up is because he doesn't know what he's doing,
yeah.
Right? He hasn't been taught how to do this job well, but they still had designs to put him in that job anyway. And Allison and Otto and all these other people, all these adults who should know better, they know they're playing with fire by putting an incompetent person an incompetent Targaryen at that on the throne. and they know they're playing with fire and they're okay with doing that. And the fact that he's making this naive choice is exposing how bad they've been at preparing him for this.
Mm, he was a fantastic foil. I love how they use foil characters in that. In this case, it's foil in relationships, and you have Viserys and Daemon and Aemond and Aegon. You show how they're like similar, but really not so similar at all.
Mm.
It's just really well.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, I think they thought he'd be more pliable. I think they thought that because he didn't want it, he would never, you know, step up at all. And that kind of surprised them.
They wanted
when he did.
Yeah, well, Otto especially wanted a puppet.
Yeah.
Puppet master over here. Well, since we're talking about brothers and you brought up Viserys and Daemon, we might as well touch on them, I think, because Daemon, obviously, is the big conversation from this season. Is Daemon just, you know, being off in Harrenhal playing Luigi's Mansion on his Nintendo Switch?
This when Daemon went his ayahuasca trip to Seven Mountains.
Yeah. I mean, we did get to see Viserys again, and I am a big show Viserys stan. Like, he is our king, and I don't care what anybody says, don't at me about that. I love Viserys in the show. So I'm not saying he's perfect, but I think the show just did a really good job of him. So it was nice seeing
the world with no decent human beings.
Yeah. It was just nice seeing him again this season.
This made me want to see Matt Smith in season 4 of Twin Peaks. Right? Wild out there stuff going on.
So yeah, my question being, what do you guys think was really going on at Harrenhal? And I'm here for some, like, what do you have a theory about it, or do you think it's a simple explanation?
Alice Rivers was drugging the heck out of him. I mean, I think she was totally.
Mm.
I think there's two suspects who is messing with Daemon. Obviously, one of them is, like you said, I can forget her name. What's her name?
Alice Rivers.
Alice Rivers is making him, you know, sitting on some trips. Or the Godswood is doing God's witty things, right? That's the other possibility. And I think it's much more interesting that actually if it's not us. Because the Godswood stuff always feels very arbitrary to me whenever we get these visions from the stuff like in Game of Thrones before.
Mm-hmm.
And this stuff feels like if Alice is actually the agent behind causing these visions, that seems very cool to me, and I want that to be the case because I want her to have an agenda and for these things to be part of her design as opposed to just like her opening his mind to visions from the Godswood, because I can't imagine that it's a coincidence that she's there.
Right.
So the question is she in some way giving him these visions, or is she just opening him up to the Godswood? That's a different question.
Mm. I find this so hard because I hate the whole thing with the burning passion. it's just like it's very coming from the fact that one of the flaws in Fire and Blood is that you have all these powerful characters and massive dragons that can fly hundreds of miles in a day and burn entire armies. And when George was writing this one, he didn't account for what was happening. Like, months were passing where Caraxes just wasn't fighting, and Rhaenyra wasn't flying her dragon to war. There was no reason. So you see in season 2, they're beating us over the head every episode with people telling her she can't go to war because they know they need to explain why she wasn't there. And so they're forced into doing that here. They're like, what the hell do we do with Daemon and the most vicious dragon in the world? We'll just sit him on an acid tree. And it just feels like a lot of this stuff for me, this is where I find a flaw in the show right now, is a lot of it's shoehorned in. Like, they're really just trying to, hey, do you think we can make a reference to the Song of Ice and Fire prophecy? It's like, let's do that, like, while he's on acid. That would be great. And it's just the fact, I think if it didn't last the whole goddamn season, I wouldn't have minded. But like, what is that, an 8-episode acid trip? For me, it's one of, I love the season, but just that part of it really killed me. So I find it very hard to even theorize on it. I'm like, I can't theorize it because it felt like she won.
I did feel like it was a little on the nose when we had the vision of Daenerys at the end. Like, really? Really? Did we have it together?
When, like, literally nothing happens from the prophecy, why are you keeping it back?
Well, to be fair, Daenerys is a descendant of Daemon and Rhaenyra.
Oh, yeah.
Like, slight spoiler, I guess, but listen, there's only so many Targaryens in the world, so. Yeah. And also, to be fair, it was like 6 episodes of it. But I agree.
That's what I said.
I agree that I really liked it for the most part, but I think they could have gotten there faster to where they were in the end.
Didn't need as many vision quests.
Yeah.
But I think it's the lack of payoff, because basically you have a Daemon at the start, okay? And Daemon at the end is essentially in the same place as a character. He was supporting Rhaenyra, and now he's supporting Rhaenyra. And we had a 6-episode journey of him just going on an acid trip and going back to the same place. If his character had moved forward and changed in a different way, because at the point he was probably the most loyal to her at that stage, and then they had a fallout, and then they go do that, and he's back to the same place. So from a craft perspective for me, the character work is incredible in almost everything in the whole show. But for me, it's because it was pointless, basically. You end up in a very similar position as you were before. Like, at the start of the first episode, he's ready to go to war. He's like, he touched the ring, he's like, get your dragon, we're gonna go kill him. Like, I'm gonna fight for my son, or like, stepson, and I'm gonna support my queen. And then in the last episode, he's in the same place. I'm gonna fight for my queen.
I do have a quarrel with that.
Oh, 100%.
I have a minor quarrel with that. You just said, I'm ready to go fight for my queen.
Fight for myself, always.
This is the one difference that at least it's certainly implied at where we are at the end of season 2 is that Daemon no longer feels motivated to claim a crown for himself.
Yeah.
Right, in parallel to Rhaenyra.
But we also didn't feel that way on the episode where he put it on her head. So
no,
we did. Well, I personally, I think I did afterwards. So like the moment where he did it, I was like, this is a nice scene because it's symbolic to him crowning his brother. When he drops the crown, this is lovely, and then like, you know, an episode later, I was like, okay, now he's back.
I think
he keeps cycling the character.
I think that if it's the case this time that he's actually flushed this out of his system now because of his magical spirit quest or whatever, then I think that's probably the character change, but otherwise, certainly from a plot standpoint, I agree with you.
Basically, the way I look at like this kind of stuff is the payoff needs to be proportional to the amount of time you spend earning the payoff.
I agree with that.
And so that's the problem. The payoff wasn't enough for me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I could be wrong.
I think that's a fair thing, yeah.
Well, even though we wax on about Damon quite a bit, in the middle of that, you mentioned Rhaenys. And I want to make sure we talk about Rhaenys because she was the major character death this season. And I
this
just love... Yeah, I saw someone gave us the justice, yes. I really, really loved her. I mean, from the start of the show, really, but this season, you knew what they were doing those first few episodes, right? Like, this princess, our princess of side eyes and sick burns, who is not taking anybody's having a far more understanding relationship with her husband, knowing, you know, that he cheated on her, that sired a bunch of bastard children. You know, give me your thoughts on Rhaenys and what she gave to us before she was taken far too early.
I mean, obviously, it really sucked that she died, but she was really she was the woman supporting Rhaenyra, and I really loved that, to see another woman, a woman supporting Rhaenyra. And now that's kind of gone. I mean, you have Baela and everything, and that's helpful, but she was really watching out for her, and I just loved that whole dynamic.
In the first season, she's the one that's talking to the two girls, right? The young Allison and young Rhaenyra. And says, listen, this is a man's world and the men are the ones who are going to mess everything up. And it's a real shame that there won't be, you know, that the women don't get to, you know, participate in this, yeah, this stuff. And which is a huge red flag for her thread, or for her arc, right? It's like, okay, now we know where she's going to go. You certainly feel, at least I felt, I'll say by the end of the second episode of the season, it's like, she should have been the queen. There's no question. Yeah. She's supported better than Viserys. She should have been the queen.
Yes.
She gets it.
Yes. She never was.
Comma, and should have been. the queen who should have been. And she's the biggest missed opportunity that we've seen in Westeros history. And that's the tragedy of the structure of the culture of the world of Westeros, right? We keep seeing all these exposures. We keep constantly getting shown and exposed to us that the way Westerosi culture has chosen to manifest the need for power has a lot of flaws, and this is one of them, right? And it's personified in her, and of course she goes down in flames.
Right.
That's emblematic of everything about this world. And I thought that was just a brilliantly done arc for her. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I'm mad that it happened means it was good.
Even on that note about the culture in the world, I always find it mad to me that you have Aegon and Visenya and Rhaenys come over and you have these dual warrior queens, and the Targaryens are like, from the start, you have dual warrior queens riding dragons, and they're so cool with women having power. And then later on, somehow it just gets pushed over. And that always.
So I always wondered if this is a thing where it's sort of like the Targaryens went native, and the world of the Seven Kingdoms is a world that can't accept women in power. And if they were back in old Valyria, this wouldn't have been a problem. But since you're over here and under the new rules, this is just not a thing that the vassals will accept. And so you have to make these concessions. And you know, it's not going to be a damaging concession because I'm a dude. I'll take that if I have to, right? and that's fine. But I think that's sort of the theory that I've had, is that's how that got taken away from the Targaryen.
And I was saying as well, like, we can see now, I'm clarifying because I know you'll get out to me if I say it, but the show, because the book's different. With Rhaenyra, she's obviously a different character in the show. In the show, they are showing that if they had just let her be fucking queen, she's far more equipped than any of them. You can see she's decent.
Right.
She wants to help. And when it comes to like actually caring about humans, she's actually good at it. You know, she's not able to wage war because she wasn't trained to wage war, but she's good at it. And that's like the other tragedies you're watching. The queen who never was, look over the queen that they won't let happen.
Yeah.
And both of them are better than anyone else who could have been in.
Right.
And that's what you're showing. And there's a little bit of the weird character work for me because you have her do that, and then you have the dragon seed scene where, like, there is no way in this world she didn't think that if one of them claimed the dragon, the rest of them were going to get burned alive. And I was like, that's a weird move from Rhaenyra, unless she's just gone full-on god complex.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I love her human moments. Rhaenys is always behind those human moments too. So it's,
I do like that Rhaenyra is clearly a peacetime queen. She's a peacetime queen. There are people who are builders and peacemen, you know, govern, people who govern, and then there are conquerors, and she's definitely not the conqueror. And Rhaenys probably could have done either one.
Yeah.
Right? She would not have wanted to, but she probably could have effectively prosecuted the war as the queen. And Rhaenyra clearly has the moxie and the components there to grow into that, to grow into what Rhaenys was. Mm-hmm. But right now, she's a person who should have been a peacetime queen, and by all rights, should currently be a peacetime queen, and she's neither the queen nor the peace.
See, right it's now. Interesting to me, because I actually, I agree with you mostly, but I feel like she took... So we talked before in the panel about how Aemon took all the negative traits of Daemon. He looked up to the wrong things, yes. He glorified the wrong things. Mm-hmm. But Rhaenyra took the positive traits of Viserys. So you can see that she understands a theme that George put into the books, which is that dragons are nuclear weapons. They are meant to be like a representation of the nuclear deterrent we have in real life. We don't go after each other because Rhaenys says it, that when the dragons go to war, we'll all burn. And Rhaenyra is more than willing to go to war, but she understands what will happen if the dragons go to war. And you can see she directly took that from her father, because he said that in front of the school. He's like, you know, we don't control them. Mm-hmm. Like, they're too powerful. I kind of like that, as in I think she could do both. I think she, instead of being just a peacetime queen, I think she's actually just the only one who actually cares about people.
I agree with that.
Like, I think there's a difference between being a peacetime queen and being a queen who actually wants to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And people are like, what do you mean you want to do the right thing? Just burn them all. You know, give up the crown, that's great.
Yeah, and also, like, because of the fact that she does seem to care about people, and including, you know, the small folk, the scene with the sowing of the seeds, where I understand her sending them to the dragon because she needed the thing, you know, she needed riders, but then to have her soldiers lock them in, essentially, was like, what? Where did this? And it was kind of like a snap, too, like if... To be honest, it felt a little bit like Daenerys at the end of the show of Game of Thrones, where it was like, wait a minute, where did this come from? Like,
she's staring down, bathed in fire, yeah. Like, oh.
Like, do I think it was going to happen this way? I can totally believe that it would. But that said, I feel like you went from point A to point Z way too quickly.
But see, there's an important thing, though. If you show the time, that if you show that progression, you're missing out on Daemon's opportunity to have Vision Quest. Sacrifice that.
If you have a question, guys, please come up to the mic to ask it, but definitely give us some audience questions, please. But until we get some, I'm going to continue on talking a little bit more about Rhaenyra and the fact that you had said that Rhaenys was the woman who was supporting her.
Mm-hmm.
But she also does have Massaria. I want to make sure that we touch on.
Yes, so. She does.
She really has Massaria now.
I just don't know how much I trust Massaria all the way. I think at some point she's going to have her own motivations. We'll see.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. I agree.
So I had a question. Characters written of Alicent as a mother. Although, so, right, House the Dragon is around the power of women and the sheer force of will that a mother has to protect her kids. In the Westeros tradition, in Game of Thrones, Catelyn Stark and her children, even Cersei, protecting the irredeemable character of Joffrey. Mm-hmm.
Daenerys and her eggs.
Right. And Alicent in season one. But Alicent in season two has seen a shift of a mother in this George R.R. Martin universe that we haven't really seen. So I'm curious of y'all's take on Alicent's character development around willing to give up one of her children.
It's honestly one of my favorite parts of the show, like the way the character worked. The moment where she finds out, I think what really turned everything was the moment where she asks Gwen, what kind of man is Daeron?
Mm.
She realized that when he said he's kind, he tried to say other things, and he's like, he's kind. And she kind of went, the only one that I didn't raise is the good one. Right? But in a serious way, like she's going, I messed these guys up. To a point that, like, Aemon would kill me. Aegon listens to me, but he's a horrible human being because I've kind of molded him into that. And the only one I didn't touch plays music, he sings, he's kind, he's nice, and he's going, and then I'm gonna have to ruin him too, because I don't need him. And I could see that flip where she kind of went, you know what, it's all about hell. It's like she finally kind of realized maybe I made one or two mistakes along the way.
I mean, to be fair, it's not entirely Allison's fault that the kids are the way they are. Like, it's not entirely her fault. And this is one of my, like, I hate to say it, but Viserys was kind of an absentee father. Like, he raised Rhaenyra, he was real there for her, but he did not give two craps about his kids with Allison.
It's only that she, I mean, like, she feels that way. She feels like it's her.
I think there's a little bit of a shift that we're seeing Allison's. Allison is the queen mother. And she's now recognizing the fact that she has a responsibility to the kingdom and not just her kids. And she's realized that she's been, like you were just saying a second ago, a failure on all fronts, right? She's been a failure to her kids, and by being a failure to her kids, she's been a failure to the kingdom. And when she sees these kids and their proximity to power, and it's their proximity to power, that this is one of the other big distinctions with, was it Darren? He's not there. He's not in court, right? And so it's their proximity to the Iron Throne is what ruins all these people, right? And everybody wants the Iron Throne. They want to control the people who sit on the Iron Throne. And it's the Iron Throne that is ruining all of these people. And she is recognizing that at least this is how I feel about it, the burden of being in power over the kingdom is a direct cost that a parent must pay in that situation. And she's discovering that she's not capable of paying, I think. She's not able to thread that needle.
I think it was always there that she might give up one of her kids to save herself in the end. I wasn't really surprised. I also feel like maybe Helena's pregnant and she's trying to help save her at the end there. Yeah, I think that it was always there because it was like she liked her kids, especially when her kids could get her power. Okay, Aegon can't really get her any power anymore. Aemon's kind of crazy, could kill her. So what else can I do?
But I think in addition to that too, it's also like Aegon being on the throne is not good for the kingdom. And Aemon being on the throne is also not good for the kingdom.
And Aemon wants to get Helena to ride to war, and she's like, that's the only other good one.
Leave Helena alone with her bugs, please. Like, this poor girl. And I think too that a lot of it is, well, first of all, Allison did not have a mother for like most of her life, right? Her mother died when she was very, very young, or I can't remember exactly, but it was at the very least very, very young, if not like right after she was born. And so she didn't have her own mother, and she was also shoved into this position of being Viserys's wife, which she didn't really want, by her dad. And like, maybe she didn't want kids either. Maybe she didn't want kids, but like got forced into having this. And it's kind of like, well, you're not going to be a good parent if you never wanted to be one in the first place. For the most part, anyway. For the most part.
Earlier, when I said that Allison hasn't been a good parent to her kids, that's not a judgment on Allison. That's a judgment on the people that put her in that spot.
Yeah, right?
She's the channel for that. She's the.
Although, listen, conduit. Allison does deserve to be judged.
What I'm saying is, it's not like Allison woke up one day and was like, I absolutely want to go be the bride of this old man so that my children will sit upon the iron throne forever. Like, that's not Allison. She got put into and allowed that situation to happen, but she's not making Machiavellian decisions to go claim the iron throne. She's not Cersei Lannister, right? She's a person who has been put in a situation that's trying to do the best she can with it, and she's not being given the tools to do a good job.
Well, and just to close this out, I want to say too that I think it's a little bit frustrating because the whole freaking first part of the season, well, really the whole like first 6-7 episodes, Allison is constantly throwing poor Helena into these like just kind of dangerous situations, you know, like the procession with Helena's son's body and the crowds that are there, and you don't know what's going to happen. And then later when she takes her out to the Sept and Helena's like, I just want to stay in the castle, and look what happens then. So it's like she's putting her in these dangerous situations over and over again. And then at the end, she's like, okay, well, now I'm going to save you because you're the only other good one I have. And it's so freaking maddening because it's like, you could have been making these like this sort of decision way back at the beginning of the season and not putting your poor daughter through all this crap.
There's a directly proportional relationship between how much she tries to protect her kids being how much they suffer.
Yeah.
Yes. The more, and it's a character thing, I actually think she's a good mother in the sense that she does want to protect them, but she keeps making the wrong choices at the wrong times,
yeah.
And every time she tries to be a good mother, she hurts them. Every single time, and it's like it's a purposeful part of the work, and it's just it's horrible. It's what makes it a tragedy.
Yeah, I think it just speaks to how complex George is with his stories. But the question I have for you guys that I was super interested in was going back to David's vision quest thing. There's one scene where he's in the God's Retreat, I forget what that's called, but he sees what looks like a child of the forest right next to the tree, and then it's gone. Kind of thing. And then you also have terrible names. Is it Alice the Witch?
Yes, Alice Rivers. Yeah.
And it seems very much like she has her own agenda and has like a broader understanding of what's going on. And that's what I love about George's work is there's like the surface level, and then there's the story underneath that you only get glimpses of. And I kind of wonder for you guys, you know, watching the work and doing this stuff for a living, if you have any thoughts about like that undertone story that is coming out as we see this, like, you know, clash of war beginning.
I don't want to get too far into this because, like, I don't, like I said earlier, I don't want to do too many, like, book spoilers, but I will say, like, him seeing that child of the forest was very interesting to me, and for those of you who have read Fire and Blood, it was very interesting because there's, like, some theories about what happens to Damon at the end of it all that involve possibly children of the forest. So like him seeing that vision, maybe it was nothing, maybe it was just fan service, or maybe it was a hint of something to come. I don't know.
It's also like ambiguity is a really powerful craft tool, and you'll find that most of the panels that we'll have are purposely left ambiguous moments, and that a great writer knows when to use it, and a poor writer uses it at the wrong moment, because there's things you need payoff for, and if you leave that ambiguous, people are unsatisfied. But if you do it right, like in that one, they don't want a definitive answer. They want us to theorize because that's what creates fandom and that's what creates this. And it's like, that's what shows how powerful those kind of things can be. It's like, I love when they do that. Like for me, I can sit here and say, I hate the whole Arnold thing, but I think Alice Rivers is like a physical, in this instance, in the way they're doing the show, is a physical manifestation of the gods searing things. And that's how I view it, but also you could be just as right, and you could be just as right, and you could be just as right. And like, they're beautiful, they're perfect moments, and Tolkien are experts at that too, just the right thing, just ambiguous enough to make us love everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a piece there that's like, apart from the fact that there's a dragon all the time, this is not a fantasy show. This is a politics soap opera. This is a political soap opera, and I made a comment once that Game of Thrones is the War of the Roses with the special guest zombie for like several seasons, right? Because the dragons don't matter. The fact that they're a dragon doesn't matter. The fact that there's a zombie doesn't matter. These are all things that we know are eventually going to matter, but the reason why you watch the show is the characters, right?
And the
dragons. And this one, the dragons matter, right? And so, but these things are, when we see things like Children of the Forest, those are reminders, like, hey, don't forget. You remember before when we told you in the last series that, like, there are gods here and there's this higher level conflict that's going on that, like, nobody in Westeros really understands? We're not letting you off the hook with the fact that this is an integral part of the setting, and the gods would still matter to the people who were here. They just haven't mattered to the characters in this story yet. Don't forget, because this may matter again later. And just even like you said, that ambiguous signpost reminds you which forest we've gotten lost in, right? And so that's why I love seeing stuff like that.
Now I need a mashup called the Westeros Wing. Because you are right, it is.
You understand that there is no piece of media that is not approved by just randomly sticking the dragon in there. The notebook, and they're going to the kids, and they're like, whoa.
Alice, at this point in time, are you excited for the third season?
I'll answer this and say that. Enthusiastically, yes. I know a lot of people, there's been a lot of talk about how people were kind of let down by the end of the season because it's like we're used to these things and they go on big crescendo battles and that sort of thing. It's like, man, all those people shouldn't be chopped up at that wedding. That was pretty great. Because people forget that like those things happen in episode, in the next to last episode, they're not actually in the finale.
Even in the books, it's in like the second, third. Like it's nowhere near. Nowhere near the end of the book.
Right. And so it doesn't really bother me that there wasn't a big exciting battle at the end of the season, because I'm not watching the show for the battles. It's a political soap opera, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting out of it. So for me, knowing that the next episode is going to be a political soap opera, and then maybe the second episode will have a big battle on it, because I'm led to believe that there's a big battle that should have happened this season and they cut it for production reasons. So for those of you who don't know, season two got cut from 10 seasons, or from 10 episodes to 8, because HBO gave that command, thou shalt cut 2 episodes. And so they sort of were like, okay, well, I guess that means this is going to happen in season 3. So I am also excited, because I think we're on borrowed boredom here, in the sense that there's going to be something that's going to be pretty high going into the next season. Okay, that doesn't bother me.
I mean, it bothered me a little bit. I was ready for it, but I knew that we weren't going to make it to that. I'm interested to see how they're going to build all that back up, because now I feel like we're going to have a whole episode to build back up to that in the start of the next season, which I feel like could be used for something else. I mean, I'm definitely excited about it for sure, but it was kind of a letdown to sit there the whole hour and then be like, yeah, this is not going to happen. Okay, I'm ready to go, and no.
I have to say, when I finished Game of Thrones, like, okay, there was a show that was great, blah, 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 and then they announced House of the Dragon. I'm like, really? Are you doing this? Are you serious? I'm not going to watch it. I'm not going to watch it. And then they cast Matt Smith, and I was in. But this show has such good character work and such compelling performances, and production values are so good. Yeah, it's a political soap opera with dragons. I'm in. These guys, they sell it. They make it work. And I'm just astonished that on paper I should not be wanting to watch this show. And I am. I'm compelled. I think it's great.
I got very confused when people started complaining that there wasn't enough action sequences.
Yeah, I agree.
It made no sense to me, because if you read Game of Thrones, he literally skips the battles.
Yeah.
Like, it is not a book about battles.
Yeah.
None of the books are about battles. Fire and Blood is not about battles. George R. Martin is a master at crafting tension. He's a master at character work. I'm waiting for like some of the battles I'm about to come up, but I can't wait to see them. They're not the things that I love, that are games I love them. It's not why I'm watching any Game of Thrones related thing, House of the Dragon. I'm watching it because of the character mechanics and the relationships and all of it. What he's a master at misunderstanding. And that's my favorite thing about all of it.
Absolutely.
These characters, if they're actually speaking to each other, which some authors use, and or screenwriters as well, use in a bad way, the main character is that would logically just talk to each other, not talk to each other. It makes no sense. These guys actually talk to each other, but they always misinterpret each other. And that's what I watched. Like, I'm really excited to watch the next season, and the action didn't bother me at all, because it's just not what the books are about. I mean, so for me, it was a weird expectation shift. When we watched Game of Thrones, it wasn't about the battles either. Like, you missed most of the battles, and it was like the biggest cultural phenomenon, the sweep of the globe. And all of a sudden, years later, we're like all about the action. And so it's like, I love the action.
Well, for me, it wasn't that there weren't enough battles. It was just that they built it up so much end, and then you're just like, so, cut for season. You know, because I feel like we got enough with Rick's Rest. I mean, to me, that was like, we got enough carnage. Yeah. It wasn't that I just needed to see more blood, more burning and everything.
More blood.
Yeah, it was just the build up to be like, okay, see you in 2 years.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue with me, is like, it's hard for me to say I'm excited for season two, because I, like, 2 years from now, I'm gonna be an entirely different place in my life, you know? I was an entirely different place 2 years prior to this, so it's hard to be excited about something that you have to wait so long for, and I feel that way about a lot of, pretty much all shows nowadays. Now that said, my biggest thing is that I do have a major concern about what season three is, like how many episodes is season three going to be, and what the heck is their budget, because they're only getting 4 total seasons. So to conclude this story in 4 seasons, even if they're not showing, you know, a bunch of battles on screen, is going to be, most of them are lumped so closely together time period wise that like, either season three is going to be truncated. I would not be surprised if season three is truncated, because if it's not, that's when all of the stuff would happen, and that seems like a very questionable like budget decision. So
it comes back to the same thing you said about Howard Hall, about how the payoff needs to be proportional to the length.
Yeah, yep, exactly.
So we're spending 2 years waiting for something, and it's not just like every episode isn't just absolute perfection. It's really hard to give it the same things. We've waited so long for it. I think in this instance, I'm a little bit terrified about what they're going to change, because I'm not a source material evangelist at all. But like sometimes you go, you bought this because George R. Martin's an amazing writer. Stop trying to think you're better. Like some of the stuff is good because it translates better into the medium, and some of the relationships they built are better. Characters are more dynamic because the book that it's written and based off isn't as deep into the characters.
Yeah.
It's more of a historical note. So doing that is better.
Yeah.
But I'm worried about some of the stuff. Oh my God, please.
I do have some sympathy though for people who sort of feel like season two broke a promise to them. We've been talking for all these episodes about the fact that there's going to be a war, and in the war we're not at war.
Still.
Right? We're not seeing that war really. I do respect people who think that's a little bit of a broken narrative promise.
Yeah.
I have a question about, sorry, I'm going to butcher their names, Rhaenyra and Viserys relationship. Like, not the gayness, but how, but how in, like, when she goes to her, she's more like a master of whispers. She speaks for the people, she does the secret stuff, and Rhaenyra talks about the less than savory things. She'll talk to the High Lords about, because she'll have a proper or moralistic opinion about it, living below with everyone else. Like, I want your opinions on their relationship and theories, how that's going to work together.
That's a great question.
I think I'm the only one with a different opinion than anyone else. I really trust her. There was a moment where she comes back and she sees Rhaenyra do something, and talk about Rhaenyra being the only decent person in the world and not decent people. I think she sees that. And I'm like, she's been used and abused and thrown around by every single person she's ever trusted. And then someone had her and could have crushed her and let her go. I think she's Rhaenyra's. I'm like, I think she's 100% there for her and going to support her until Rhaenyra does something weird.
It's not fair to look at characters and say to look at characters from Game of Thrones and say where is that person again in this work. Although it's pretty easy to find who's the Littlefinger in this scenario. We know who the Littlefinger is. That's Larys, right? But like, I have kind of wondered if what's her name?
Viserys.
I have wondered if she's not going to prove to be a lot like Tyrion, in the sense that Tyrion basically at core is a good guy. And he's the person the audience wants to see get a win. And he may not always make the decision that we wanted to make, but we understand where he comes from. And generally speaking, Tyrion does care about the good of the people of Seven Kingdoms. And I think that she might be one of those people.
I feel like a combination between Tyrion and Varys.
Yeah, Varys is also one of those people who he thinks in service of the people of Seven Kingdoms. He doesn't care for the people.
If you're not gone absolutely crazy,
right?
He will support you.
That's right. But he cares more about the people than he cares about the people that are in power.
Yeah.
And he's not loyal to people. He's not loyal to a person. He's loyal to an idea. And I think she is like that. She's like Varys.
I do think she's loyal. I want other people to talk and there's more questions, but I really do think that she actually is loyal to Rhaenyra as well.
That could be.
Otherwise there's a misnomer in character work. For me, when I look at it, I go, that's great, because you watch her go, this is someone who, if we put on the throne, will care about people, and so I want to care about her, and that's what I get.
I think there is the possibility that there is we are being set up for the possibility that she and Rhaenyra could have a disagreement and she goes a different way, but I think on current facts, I agree with you.
Yeah, I think she's loyal to Rhaenyra right now. I think she believes in Rhaenyra. I think she's glad to help uplift another woman, so... We'll see how long that goes for.
Right, yeah. I think that, like with any relationship, that trust can be broken. But for now, and I also think Missaria, she has her own, like she has the way she wants things to go, right? She wants the small folk to be taken care of. That's a huge generalization of probably what she wants. But minus it being a generalization, I think that she thinks... Right now, Rhaenyra is of the same mindset, to at least to an extent, that a queen can be. And until or unless Rhaenyra breaks from that specific thing that Missaria has this goal, this aim to do, then
like,
yeah,
they're 100 of them alive.
Also, just because you mentioned Varys, I want to say, like, if anybody rewatches this, or if you know what I'm talking about by me saying this, Missaria's clothing really does evoke Varys.
Yeah,
Varys is a season. The belt, the big open sleeves, the way she stands with it, and everything. So if you rewatch, definitely keep an eye out for that, because I caught that toward the end of the season. I was like, how did I? And then I went back and I was like, oh, she's been wearing these like since she started hanging out with Rhaenyra. Okay.
I think it's been low though, because the costume designers and the set designers are known for doing it.
Yeah.
Like how they made Sansa's hair and like everyone she was looking up to at the time. Like they do it on purpose, so like it actually means something. It's not just going, just kind of connecting threads.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's 100% potential.
Hi. I want to go back to Rhaenys, and I'm sorry, I'm going to reference a little thing from season one, but I want to see how you think it ties into her overall character. She's amazing. I love her. Love the actress. In season one, she does something where two questions about when she and Morassi's break through the floor during Aegon's coronation. So two things, because y'all said she would make a great queen, both kind of peacetime and warrior different aspects. So one thing is she killed a whole bunch of common people, which I was like, whoa, that's a lot to this character.
She's still a Targaryen.
And two, she doesn't end the war when she possibly could.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of stuff going on in her head, and that's why I want y'all's take on how that reflects on her character.
I think it's literally a flaw in the adaptation.
Yeah,
there's
me
no
too.
Other answer. Like, as in, that was never meant to happen. It's inconsistent with her character, and it would also be completely goddamn stupid. Now, I know there's a big thing about laws and the way family and kin and patricide and things work in Game of Thrones, and there's very little that's viewed as worse than kin and family members. So, like, it, even more so than the real world, like, it's a genuine thing they have in the world. But, like, the showrunners literally went, that would be really cool. Let's make her do that. And put her in a position that she couldn't do the logical choice. And I talk on the panel about like internal character consistencies, and that's what draws me out of work, is if a character doesn't make the choice that that character should make based on the information they have and who they are, and gone from the world. And at that moment, that's what happened. This character murders loads of people who she doesn't seem like the kind of person who would, and then also makes the silly choices. And it was very much to me like a, let's do something cool. We're not going to think about how that has ramifications on the character we're later on. That was
involved. I entirely agree with what everyone with that. I thought that scene, there's a term in wrestling called heat, which is when a wrestler shows up onto the into the arena and there's that the crowd is cheering for them. And wrestlers can have what's called cheap heat. Cheap heat is where they come in and they if they're a heel, if they're a bad man wrestler. You can get cheap heat by yelling at the crowd and talking about how stupid the city is that they're in. Like, oh, I hate you, Atlanta. Atlanta's a terrible place. And that gets the crowd to boo, and that gets the crowd worked up. And that's cheap heat. Putting a dragon on screen is cheap heat. And putting a dragon on screen unopposed against pointed to characters is really cheap heat. That's really going to get my attention in that scene. And it's going to get me really invested in what's about to happen, because especially in this world, that means somebody is probably about to have a bad day, and then nothing happens. And I thought that was out of character, both for the character and for the world. Like, for this universe, that doesn't track. It pulled me out of it. It felt like a violation of the character and of the rules of this world. And it felt like cheap. It felt like this is something where the writers thought something was really cool was going to get our attention, and it was cool.
Yeah,
I agree with all of that too. I was going to say, I think that they did that as her like kind of getting back at them for locking her up, but then she doesn't kill Aegon or anybody because she doesn't want to start the war. She doesn't want to be a kinslayer.
Right.
So they kind of counted it out. They kind of scratched it out, and it just made no sense to me.
Who here has experienced road rage, right? You might get real mad in that moment and honk your horn or flip someone off, but maybe you'll stop short of rear-ending them on purpose. Hopefully. Okay, guys, let's not do that, right? But I think that we also have to remember Rhaenys is a Targaryen. She still have that fire in her blood.
Like,
so 15
minutes to cool off as she ran down those stairs. Have you seen how high those walls are?
But it's not just that, too. It's also, this is supposed to be a savvy political actor. What have we just seen? What we've seen is they held a crowning ceremony. She showed up. and let them get away with it.
Kill those innocent people.
That's like the kid takes the cookie out of the cookie jar in front of you, and you look at them and say, "Is that really something you want to be doing?"
There's
your
dead
kid. Yes. Well, I'm gonna go watch TV now. I hope you learned your lesson. Yes, I did just learn a lesson. Right? I absolutely learned a lesson.
Okay. We're going to go into speed round mode, which means ask your question, and the first person who answers it gets to say their answer, and then we move on, because I want to make sure we get through the four of you that are in line.
With the events of Blood and Cheese, I just wonder what your guys is, what do you think is going to go with her, like that whole incident and then Helena in the future?
I think it broke Helena a little bit, but I think the aftermath of that is was the worst part of it, with Allison continually like putting her in these just really bad situations. So the thing is, Helena was already kind of, I mean, she's a dreamer, you know? She's been drawing prophecies on the walls of her bedroom her entire life. So I don't know, it for sure broke her, and I don't think she's gonna come back from that, but I think it's gonna be a lot worse if she ends up being forced to go to war.
With the way that the season ended, who do we feel is playing checkers and who's playing chess? Because it's a reference that we've seen a lot of the time within the show, even if it's not necessarily said, but we see like the Master of Whispers and other people who are playing chess and having a conversation during small pieces.
Or no one on Team Green is playing chess except Laris.
Maybe Otto. But Otto's imprisoned right now, so he ain't playing anything.
So back to Alice Rivers, there was a scene when Damon and Alice were talking in like the dining area of Aaron Hall, and Simon Strong walks in and Alice seemingly vanishes. Not doesn't walk past him, just vanishes. Do you think the writers are trying to make you believe it's a vision of his and she's not an actual physical person in the series?
I think, like, for me, that's what I was saying earlier, I think I feel from stuff like that, like, it's meant to be ambiguous, but I feel like when I see things like that, that's what makes me go, yeah, I think she is, they have, everyone, a lot of people read, you know, soft and hard magic systems, and Game of Thrones is a very soft magic system where he likes to be able to just do things. I think that's one of the things he's doing, is that, like, he's implying in this instance that the gods are kind of using Alice as, like, a proxy. She's like this avatar, she appears, whispers some shit, gives him ayahuasca, and then comes back in, does it again, and then leaves. And it's like us being able to see the hand.
It has not been a
curse. She was which?
That she's not real.
It's implied a lot of the time to like the whispers he hears, like when and her
was in. So I didn't get that, right? But.
At the very end, I honestly agree, like I thought that's what they were trying to do, but then at the very end, Simon Strong says like, oh, well, yeah, Alice, our healer, Alice Rivers, went to the Tullys, and it's like, oh, okay, so he does see her.
She's real, but I feel like she's, like, you can see her, but she can also choose not to be seen. Like, she's like, she is a manifestation, she's like a, not a demon, but a spirit, like, and it's actually implied in some of the texts as well, that she's 500 years old, and that's one of the things, But one of the theories is she 30 or is she 500? Yeah. And that's like an actual thing. So it feels like that's what they're leaning into for this. She's more steroidish than she is person with drugs.
That's
cool.
Thank you. All right, last question.
So season two, we see multiple major characters sneak in and out of King's Landing after the murder of an heir to the throne. Did that have great plausibility for anyone on the panel?
It did not break plausibility for me as much as the order that humans can't leave the city.
Yeah.
Humans can't leave the city, but you also have to get food into the city. What?
Right.
No, I'm not here for the logistics of things.
Definitely broke it for me a lot.
Yeah.
But they did actually try and answer it. So they actually talk about it. And it's like, how did this person get in? They got in the fish and ships. And it's like, oh, well, that's it. Eamon actually does it. He goes, all the fish and ships, they go in.
Yeah.
No one comes in there, because that's how they're getting in a lot of the time. And then they kind of explain, well, that's our only source of food. And they actually explain it. They close the gates, and that's part of why they're starving. And the only food source is coming from the sea, which is why they can't stop the ships, which is why people keep sleeping in the ships.
Yeah.
And so, like, they do want a little bit of consistency with it, but it's still just a little bit.
Emerson says a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin and the little lines, but a foolish consistency, why are the gates closed? I don't understand.
I mean, it's been kind of a joke since Game of Thrones, honestly. Remember when Jaime Lannister snuck into Dorne? Like, that was a whole hot mess, and I almost feel like, are they just trying to...
You just put on some FaceTime and just
Yeah, like, are they just trying to continue this sort of silly tradition? But yeah, I mean, it does, it breaks it a little for me, but then at the same time, it's like, it's funny enough that I kind of am like, yeah, they're going to keep doing this, and I'm going to keep making fun of it, and I'm going to enjoy it that way. All right, guys, we have got to conclude, but do not forget to donate to the DragonCon charity in the name of the High Fantasy Track. We don't have our bucket here. It's in the High Fantasy Room, but make sure to rate us 5 stars if you liked us, or don't rate us if you didn't. Have a great rest of your convention, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Geek Saga podcast. If you like what you heard, please check out other Geek Saga entertainment endeavors, including the Sagas and Sass webcast and podcast, and Ice and Fire Con.